Rebecca and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the 830 National Hills group. Before I get started, first of all, I would like to thank the planning committee. And I was talking to Scott S., a member of the National Hills group as well, last night, and he was giving me some of the details of all the planning and the effort that goes into planning something like this so big for all of us to come here together. And I don't know all of you on the committee, but I thank you. And if you would have asked me almost 5 years ago when I walked into the rooms, I would be standing here today. I would have told you were slap nuts. So I am really happy to be here. It is an honor and it is a pleasure. So thank you. Before I get started completely, I would like to read something as it relates to me. It's on page 315, and it's in the story, and it's called My Chance to Live. If everyone who needed AA showed up, we would be bursting at the seams. Unfortunately, never most make it to the door. I believe I was one of the lucky ones. Not just because I found this program at such a young age, I feel fortunate that I found AA at all. My approach to drinking brought me to the jumping-off place described in the book, much faster than anyone could have imagined. I'm convinced if I had continued on my course, I wouldn't have survived much longer. I don't believe I was smarter than anyone else, as I often am told by those who came in at a later age. It was my time, my chance to live, and I took it. If there had still been any joy in my drinking or even a remote chance of joy returning, I would have not stopped drinking when I did. So I'm just going to start at the beginning. So my sobriety date is November the 14th, 2011. My home group, like I said, is the 830 National Hills group. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor and so on. Let's see. Drugs are part of my story. However, I keep it to the minimum. I can't change my story, but it is part of it. However, alcohol and alcohol alone strictly led me back to these rooms. A lady who is an old timer in the rooms gave me a really good piece of advice a few years ago. She says, anytime you tell your story, you keep it raw for yourself as well as the newcomer that's in the room. And that made a lot of sense to me. Let's see. So I was born on November the 9th, 1988 in Bamberg, South Carolina. If you do the math, that puts me at 27 years old. God willing, I'll have a birthday next month. I come from a wonderful family. I can't even come close to blaming my drinking on the family that I was raised in. My mom was very nurturing, and she was the homemaker, and she would do anything in the world for you, and she is sitting on the second row today. So, cool. My dad was very strict and very stern, and when you were in his house, you wore a knee-length skirt, and you were a lady, and that's just the way it was. You know, he didn't tell me that he loved me all the time and things like that, but he showed it through his actions. And it's crazy because when I came into the rooms, they told me that this was a program of action, and that made a lot of sense to me, and it still does today. I have one older sibling. He's 6.5 years older than me. He sits in the second row today as well. I have a very supportive family. However, I drug my family along for a very long time. And I'm not proud of that. But what it is what it is. So there is no emotional abuse, no sexual abuse, no kind of abuse in my home whatsoever. You went to church on Sundays, you went to church on Wednesdays, you went to school, etc. It was a very normal home life, as normal as whatever normal can be. So I went to elementary school, middle school. It was all a breeze for me. I've heard so many speakers say that they felt very different at a young age, but I didn't feel different. I felt like I fit in for the most part. I had a little shy side to me, but other than that, that was pretty much it. I just kind of went along. When I went into my ninth grade year of Cross Creek, a school here in Augusta, you know, I was a freshman there, and I had my first boyfriend, and life was good, and I wouldn't have considered myself a very popular kid, but I just kind of blended, I guess. I had a very close-knit group of friends. Me and this guy dated up until my sophomore year. We were going to get married. That didn't work out. So anyway, the end of my sophomore year, and I don't exactly know why, but I wasn't introduced to alcohol. I introduced myself to alcohol, if that makes any sense. But I told two of my friends that since her parents were out of town, we're going to walk across the street because her parents had a mini bar and we were going to raid it. So not knowing much about alcohol at all, we raid her parents' mini bar. And then in the rap songs, they sung about Bacardi. So we went and grabbed the Bacardi 151. And it was, I don't remember much after that, but we just kind of... We just lined the shots up on the kitchen counter, sorry about that, Mom, and just, you know, started going at it. And I knew that when I put that alcohol in my body for the first time, I loved the effect, period. There was no other way around it. And they called a friend, I believe, to come get me, and I vaguely remember coming up my parents' steps, and I knew if I didn't go straight to my room and go to bed, that if my parents found out that I was drinking, I was in big, big trouble. So a few hours later, I get a knock on the door, and it's my dad. And he's like, "Hey, Rebecca Gale, why don't you come eat dinner with us?" And I said, "I'm not hungry," because I was feeling real sick by this point. And I'll never forget, but he made me finish every single thing on my plate. And it shortly later came back up. And he never said anything, but I always wonder if he knew, because he was never, you know, if you didn't finish everything on your plate, it really wasn't that big of a deal. But for some reason, that particular day, he did. So anyway, I went back to, you know, school as usual and met a few other different crowd of people. And by the summer, I was introduced to house parties and keg parties, and I really liked that way of life. If I would have told you that my early drinking wasn't fun, I would be a complete liar. I had a blast. And we went all the way from Augusta to Statesboro to Lincolnton to Burke County. Everywhere there's a party, I would be there. And along the way, right before my junior year, I was introduced to, of course, pot, and I really enjoyed that too. And anyway, so I went back into my junior year, and you know, that summer before, you know, they say if you put yourselves in certain circumstances, you know, bad things will happen, and I won't go into the details, but, you know, an unfortunate event occurred in my life, and so I remember when I went back my junior year to high school, the hallways seemed very large. Everything seemed so overwhelming, and when I hear speakers speak about they felt different, that's when I felt different. All my insecurities arose. Life was just different. But I took myself back to that Bacardi 151, and I knew that that would do the trick. So I continued to drink that first semester. I barely showed up to class. I went from being an AB honor roll student with no trouble at school whatsoever to failing 6 out of my 7 classes my junior year. I made a really great decision to drop out of high school and go and get a GED, a.k.a. good enough diploma. And my dad was like, you know, you need to go to Augusta Technical College and get a trade and do something with your life. So I went there and found some more friends and continued to party a little bit harder. And by then, early consequences started to come. One morning, once again, I get that knock on the door. And my dad told me to pack all my bags and get out, that he wouldn't condone the lifestyle that I was living, because Mom was finding alcohol as well as other substances in my vehicle, etc. She was a great snoop. So anyway, I left home and I went and I stayed with a friend, and that only lasted a couple months, because once again I had a bright idea that I was going to take her 15-year-old Davidson Fine Arts student sister out for the night. And by this point, I had already caught a misdemeanor for shoplifting. And I had $300 in my car when I shoplifted at the time. I just like to steal things because I like to get away with it. And, I mean, the isms were already there, like, well before. And anyway, so I take this girl out, and we end up, getting pulled over, and I'm driving this guy's vehicle, and I'm DUI, and it turns out he doesn't have any insurance on it, and there's six people in the car, but there's really only five seats in the car, and it's 3:30 in the morning, and I'm in a t-shirt and a pair of high heels, and I tell this cop, I'm pleading with him, you know, please don't take me back to jail. My parents are going to kill me. Please don't do this to me. And he ends up arresting two of the six people that I'm with because they're acting out really bad, and I somewhat kept my composure. And so at 3:30 in the morning, it's hard to get in touch with anyone. So I call everyone to, you know, come pick me up, and no one's answering. So I have to call Nana, who I refer to, which is who I'm living with. It's my friend's grandmother. This is who I'm living with at the time. Her granddaughter that I'm out with, and her granddaughter's so messed up, she has no idea what's going on. So anyway, she comes and picks me up, and before I can get in the vehicle, I hear, pack your bags and get out. This is already becoming a routine, so I call my parents, and Dad smiles and says, absolutely, you can come back home. You're 6 months away from being 18. You will not leave this house unless you are going to the church or you're going to work. My first job was at Dairy Queen. I stayed there for about a year and a half. And anyway, but between the age of 16 and the age of 20, I literally counted 14 jobs. See, I could always get a job, but I could never keep it. And especially when it went into with my drug of choice, they wanted me to show up on time. They wanted me to show up on the right date, preferably. And that kind of didn't work out so well for me. So I saw my red line through that schedule a lot, and it never bothered me. I was like, oh, I'll just go get another job. And I had, by this point, moved in with an during the time period that I wasn't supposed to go anywhere or do anything, like any good alcoholic, I stacked my money from DQ. And 2 months later, I hop on a bus to Virginia Beach to see the girl that I drank with for the first time because she had moved up there with her dad. And I drank whiskey, which was my drink of choice, the whole ride up. And I was so drunk, I got off in the wrong city before I could get there. So this probably should have been my first sign, but it wasn't. During this time period, I convinced my brother that he should let me move in with him when I come back. And so he let me move in with him, and I stayed with him for another couple years. I was not quite 18 years old at the time. And, you know, he had very low amount of rent that I was supposed to pay him. I can count on one hand how many times I paid him rent. I would be gone for days or a week at a time, and he had no idea where I was at. I had no idea until I got sober how much damage I had done until going through the 12 steps. So I get back and I stay with him, and I can't maintain a job. Drinking as well as my drug of choice has rapidly increased by this point. And by the age of 20, I find myself roughly 30, 35 pounds lighter than I stand today. And I am not doing well financially, emotionally, spiritually. You know, I'm bouncing around couch to couch because of the shame of coming back to my brother's house in the condition that I was in. So I knew that I needed help. I reached out to my family, and within 48 hours, I was being shipped off 5 hours down south, Morven, Georgia, which used to be the Bridges of Hope for Women. Now, I had seen on the intervention shows where they go to treatment and they're like at the beach and it's like maybe 90 days tops. And so I had a really rude awakening when I went to the Bridges of Hope. Man. But it taught me two really important things. Number one, it planted the seed for recovery because I wasn't quite done yet. And number two, it actually taught me a little bit of a work ethic because I didn't have one. By 30 days in, the director told me that if I was late for count one more time, I would wear an alarm clock around my neck to outside meetings. I wasn't late anymore after that. So eventually I got out of the Bridges of Hope, and when I got out, they told me to go to AA meetings to get a sponsor, to work the 12 steps, to keep coming back. So I went to AA meetings, I beat around the bush with a sponsor, I didn't work thorough through the steps, found me a boyfriend, which they told me not to do, and it's pretty much what I did. And 3 days prior to picking up a 9-month chip, I left work, and I was sitting at the Veracruz on Stevens Creek Road by myself drinking a Coca-Cola, eating a nacho cheese chicken burrito, and the waiter walks by with margaritas, and I was like, oh, that fruity little drink ain't nothing. I think I'll have one. And that was it. Now, this job that I got, my brother had lined it up for me and told me not to screw it up this time because he knew this general manager at a local hotel here in Augusta. When I went on the interview, she looked at my criminal background and told me that she didn't hire thieves, but I beg and I plead with her to give me this job. So she does. And after that first relapse, I bounced in and out of the rooms for almost another 3 years. I stayed out the first 6 months after that first margarita. I stayed out for 6 months after the fact, and then eventually came dragging back into the rooms. And I came in, and I came out, and I didn't take suggestions, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't work the 12 steps, and I didn't come to meetings before, and I didn't stay after meetings to socialize. I didn't do any suggestion that they gave me whatsoever, because at the end of the day, I wanted to get drunk more than I wanted to stay sober. That's pretty much what it boiled down to. During this time, like any good alcoholic, I thought that I was doing good because when I started off at that hotel, she let me start off as a dishwasher. And eventually I try to earn this woman's trust, and I moved from a dishwasher to an AM server to a PM server to a banquet server to running a full banquet department. So the way that it looked from the outside didn't look bad. I had my own vehicle. I had my own apartment. I didn't have children. I was single. I was fully self-supporting. And I was going to drink when and where I wanted to drink. And that was a simple fact. It says in the book, you know, we tried to switch our drinking. Well, whiskey always did it, you know. So I was like, well, I'll just drink beer. And beer led to shots and so forth. And, you know, after the first time I went out, it was like, well, I'll just go out on the weekends when I don't have a lot of events. And then the weekends turned into Monday, and Monday turned into Tuesday. And eventually I found myself sitting on a bar stool 6 out of 7 nights a week, because the seventh I was either too sick or too broke. It was one or the other. I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get off the bar stool. So, like I said, I came in and out of the rooms. And from the outside, everything looked okay. But deep down inside, it was not okay. Sure, I drank for the effect because I liked it. But I drank for many other reasons as well. I drank because I was sad. I drank because I was happy. I drank because it was Tuesday. It was just that simple. And you know, by the age of 20, I had already buried 3 friends to drinking and driving accidents and 1 very dear friend to an overdose. And you would have thought that somewhere along the line that it would have opened my eyes, but it never did. It just didn't. I'm hard-headed. I have to learn things the hard way, unfortunately, like so many of us. So anyway, long story short, between almost 3 years of coming in and out of the rooms, I never put more than 34 days of dry time together. The reason that I call that dry time is because nothing about my life was sobriety-oriented at all. I was just simply dry. The last time that I walked into the rooms, I put 27 days of dry time together, and I went back out. I didn't change my people, I didn't change my places, and I didn't change my things. Because I wasn't willing and I wasn't ready to let them go. I wasn't willing to take the old-timer's suggestions or do anything different. On November the 13th of 2011, the day before my sobriety date, which was my last drunk, a former boyfriend contacted me on Facebook and asked me if I wanted to meet for drinks. And I said, well, why not? So if anyone's familiar with the area, I meet him at Limelight Bar, which is right across the street from the big light-up theaters. And we meet there, and he met me there on his motorcycle. I met him there in my vehicle. And we drank, and we moved from beer to tequila very quickly. Whenever he left the bar, he was traveling down Skinner Mill Road in the direction of Boy Scout Road under the influence. He crossed lanes going at 90 miles per hour. He hit a car head-on. His motorcycle flew against the retaining wall of I-20, and his body went the opposite direction. I then came through, I ran over him, and I continued to drive. The following morning, I remember walking outside and noticed the bottom fog light on the driver's side of my car was completely missing. So I then approached my vehicle after the drunken night before, and I noticed there was blood splatter all the way down from the front driver's side of my car to the back. So I get on my hands and knees, and I look underneath my vehicle, and I see the same blue threading that Russell's shirt was the night prior. So I very quickly try to put together my pieces. I can vaguely remember walking back into the apartment that no longer mattered and sitting underneath a cafe sign that was in my kitchen in a fetal position and literally ripping the hair out of my head. So what do? I phone Big Brother because he'll be able to help me. And I can literally remember him going silent for a good few minutes because he didn't know what to tell me. And he says, maybe you should phone a family member that previously worked for law enforcement that can maybe help you walk you through this because you got to do something. You can't be swept under the rug. So, you know, there were many nights that I drove home and I don't remember getting home and I blacked out. My routine basically consisted of getting up, going to work, getting off work, drinking, blacking out, passing out, coming to, throwing up, and doing it all over again. I can literally remember the smell of bacon and eggs every time I worked in that hotel, and nausea instantly began to set in. But it didn't matter. It wasn't enough. The cold bathroom floors wasn't enough laid out before I got on my serving shift. So I phoned this family member. Sunday the accident happened, which was my last drunk. I have not found it necessary to pick up a white shift since. Monday I put together my pieces. Tuesday I made a written statement to the police. For the next 4 days I was under an investigation. They confiscated my vehicle, etc. Friday I was arrested for a felony hit and run. So many people ask me why the charge wasn't higher. And the simple fact is that cause of death could not be determined. Russell left behind a daughter who is currently 8 years old and a sister who was a senior in high school. It wasn't until then how I realized that my drinking affected everybody else around me. So I go to jail, and the plan was to book me in and bond me out, but Judge Blanchard put a hold on me because of the death. So eventually, after about a week, they consider I wasn't a flight risk, and my family got me out on a property bond. I remember day two in jail. I was in block E. I was in cell E1, and there's about 25 women on the block, and everyone went quiet, and they were looking at me. And my face was on every news channel in Augusta. I literally cannot explain the humiliation that went with that. And it didn't just affect me. It affected my family's name. It affected everyone around me. I did not come from a wealthy home. My parents didn't have money just to turn over for lawyers, etc. So after I got out after that week, I went to see my employer. She said, we're not going to kick you while you're down. Here's this lovely lady named Lisa. You're going to train her to run your banquet department. You're going back to washing dishes. I forgot to include that 6 months prior to me quitting drinking, I had picked up a second job at the DoubleTree as a standard server because the bills at that hotel, because the money I was making at that hotel was no longer supplying my alcohol need. So I was immediately let go from there. I had no idea how I was going to pay my bills or what I was going to do. And the next place I went was the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in and I wore a hat for months. Strayler to be my sponsor. There's two reasons that I asked the gentleman to be my sponsor. One, I knew that he would thoroughly walk me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me that if I wanted the promises they read in every meeting to come true, then I better put the pen to paper. So I was ready and willing to do it. And number two, I had to do a fourth and fifth step with him. I had to make sure that whatever I told him was completely confidential, and I knew he would keep that. And I wanted what him and the old-timers had. And I wanted what some of the people that came in before me had. But I didn't know how to get it. But I just kept coming back. And I figured if a fourth of the promises would come true, then I'd be doing all right. And I was willing to settle with that. So I kept coming back. I picked up my six-month chip. 3 days later, I went back in front of Judge Blanchard here in Augusta. I remember, I'll never forget, he told the victim's parents to please step forward. I was no longer the victim, nor I could play it. It came out the judge's mouth alone. He didn't send me to 5 years of incarceration that he could have. What I do know today is that God walked with me in that courtroom. The God of my understanding walked with me in that courtroom, and he walked me right back out. Part of my sentencing was to go out to local high schools and the CSRA and give talks on the dangers of drinking and driving. I've completed 181 hours. I have 200 to complete. It's taken 4 years. It's not like my recovery talk when I go out to the high schools. I tell them I partied hard, I thought I was cool, and this was the end result of getting behind the wheel under the influence. There's not quite as much hope in that story. But one thing I did was, the first year I was at 2 and 3 meetings a day. And I didn't have, and I couldn't drive, obviously, you know. So I walked back and forth to work for over a year. Thank God that I worked at a hotel because they have blow dryers in the rooms and sometimes it rains. I continued to work through the 12 steps thorough with a sponsor. I continued to keep coming back. I came before meetings. I stayed after meetings. I took every single suggestion that I could get because my way did not work anymore at all. That was clear. You know, each step taught me something. Step one, I always knew I was powerless over alcohol, but I just didn't care. But when I finally came back, for God willing, that last time, I knew that my life was unmanageable. It was literally falling apart. Step two, when I did the paperwork on step two, something that really stood out to me was, it said, name the 10 worst things that's happened to you in your life. So I just boom, 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 jot them down real quick. I flip the page, and it says, out of the 10 worst things that's happened in your life, was alcohol involved in any of these? So I flip back over the page. Every single one, it was a home run. The insanity was there. As far as giving my life over to the God of my understanding, you know, I grew up thinking that my God was a punishing God. If I did bad things would happen. But what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was a new outlook on my God. And that was that he was a loving God. He was a merciful God. He brought me back into the rooms in one whole piece, physically speaking. And it's just like I read. It was my chance to live, and I took it. When I got into 4 and 5, you know, I could finally see my part in things. The very person at the top of my resentment list was myself. I hated myself. I thought that I was a bad human being. But what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me was that I'm not bad. I was a sick, sick individual, and I needed to get better. And that gave me a lot of hope. It really did. 6 and 7, my sponsor added a few to the list when we did that. And once I worked through them, then I had to work on them. So that was great. You know, when I moved into 8 and 9, it was extremely vital for sponsorship. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just ready to go start knocking on doors and telling everyone I'm sorry. And I was sorry, that was for sure, but that wasn't the way you went about it. The way the eighth step was done with me was I made a list. And when I made that list, I had so much guilt that when we were looking over the list, it was brought to my attention. I had second and third parties on my list. So it was beneficial for that to be pointed out. I had now amends. I had partial amends. I had later amends. And I had never amends. And I'll share one with you that really stood out to me because this is a program of action. They told me never to come empty-handed. My brother's sitting here on the second row today. I owed him a partial amends because part of that amends was when I was out there and when I lived with him, I stole directly out his wallet with no hesitation. And I stole from him. And anyway, I'll never forget, he's an electrical work at the mall one day, and we met there for lunch, and I went ahead and went into the emotional part of my amends first. And you know, you never know what you're walking to or what you're getting into, but the response I got back was, you have no idea what it's like. You have no idea to wonder where your sister is for a day or a week at a time. You have no idea what it's like to walk into the living room and shake you just to make sure you're up or you're breathing. He told me just not to drink anymore. And I said, well, I can't promise that, but just for today, I'm not going to take a drink. The second part of that amends, I slid a $100 bill across the table and I said, I stole directly from you. Please let me pay you back, bit by bit. I can't pay it all in full. But what I was taught was not to go empty-handed. That was very important. 10 was continuing to learn the 1 through 9 that was taught to me, that I put on pen and paper and put that in my life. It has really been beneficial. You know, I sponsor other women in the rooms, and every time that I take them through a step, it's like me going over it over and over again. And that's what helps keep me sober today. Really bad things have happened in sobriety that have been out of my control. Really great things have happened to me in sobriety. I'm going to share the bad, and then I'm going to share the good. So, a few bad things. This disease is out to get me, and this disease is out to kill me. And I've had to bury a few in the National Health Group due to this disease. Every time that I attend a funeral and put on that black dress, it is another unfriendly reminder of why I don't pick up. At day 5 months sober, I went back to Statesboro, Georgia, where my friend had overdosed at 17, and I buried his mother, 58 years of age, in a plot right beside him for an overdose. Once again, it was another unfriendly reminder. At day 11 months sober, I bury an employee that I had worked with for 3.5 years to a suicide. These were things out of my control, completely out of my control. October the 5th made 3 years this month, but I was coming out of my 8:30 home group meeting, and I got a call from a deputy that told me I needed to come straight home. So with no hesitation, I jump in my car and I go to the house. There I find my mom sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch, my brother's there, a whole bunch of people are there, etc. And they informed me that my dad had taken his own life that night. This was a month prior to my 2-year celebration. I had two options. I could go back and I could drown it, or I could persevere just like my sponsor had told me to. I can't tell you how many times I heard that. Keep persevering, Rebecca. It's going to get better. When's it going to get better, trailer? You know? But I just kept on keeping on. And the event from that night, I will include that I can count how many times I saw my dad drink a beer with his steak. And that particular day, instead of turning to family, friends, and the God of his understanding, he turned to a bottle of gin, shot himself. So for me, once again, another unfriendly reminder. I don't know what I'm capable of when I put alcohol into my body. So just for today, I choose not to put it in my body or any other substance. With that death, I went to a meeting and I shared where I was at. You know, not everyone understands how I feel, but I have found in the rooms that people can relate to how I feel. And the rooms and the support group and a sponsor is what carried me through that and still does today. I moved in with my mother. I packed everything up I owned in storage, thanks to Steve Waters here. And he gave me a storage unit. And I moved back in with my mother for approximately 13 months. And our relationship became stronger. And I was able to give back a little bit of everything that I had taken. And we were able to build on our relationship. For that, I'm grateful. Some really great things has happened. When I moved out of there, I married this lovely man who is my host today. When I came into the rooms, I was just a girl out on a felony $10,000 bond and hoped she'd send me a care package because I knew I was facing prison time. But instead, I married and my wonderful brother walked me down that aisle. It's a really great thing. I have a niece. January 4th, she will be 4 years old. She's never seen me under the influence. I've never missed a birthday. And there were so many events that I missed. One of the family members that put me out of their house, they have three children that for a year time period I wasn't allowed on the property or able to see them. Me and my husband just took them on a 4-day camping trip this past summer. You know, I have a relationship with my family today. I have a wonderful support group that I consider my second family today. My life has drastically changed because of these rooms. Sure, drugs and alcohol quickly changed the course of my life in a negative way. But this program, over a time period, because I just gave it a shot and stuck around, it's really worked out. You know, I went from washing dishes at that hotel to taking a management position just a few months ago. So it's amazing what God has done in my life. If you're in treatment, really hope that you stick it out. Take advantage of it. Because when I got sober, my dad told me that I couldn't go back to treatment because now he had attorney fees. And they forked out a lot they didn't have to ensure that. The dinners that I used to have are no longer awkward. They were really awkward at first when I got sober. There wasn't much to discuss, needless to say. So this program has completely turned my life around. Today I'm a wife. Today I'm a daughter. Today I'm a sister. Today I'm a friend. Today I'm a manager. Today I'm a law-abiding citizen. Today I'm all them things. Whereas before, I was just a lost girl. That's exactly what I was, a lost girl with no hope. And this program gives it to me on a daily basis. Anyway, I am about out of time, and I'm going to read again something for y'all. And I read the big book a lot, especially my first year, because when you go home to an empty apartment and there's no one there, all you have is the God of your understanding and a big book and a TV to drown out your thoughts and hope that you can at least get a few hours of sleep. And that was how the first 4 or 5 months played out. Along the nights of many readings, I found this. It's on page 318. Life has not heaped monetary riches upon my head, nor have I achieved fame in the eyes of the world. My blessings cannot be measured in those terms. No amount of money or fame could equal what has been given to me. Today I can walk down the street anywhere without the fear of meeting someone I've harmed. Today my thoughts are not consumed for the craving for the next drink, the regret for the damage I did on my last drunk. Today I reside among the living, no better, no worse than any of God's other children. Today I look in the mirror when putting on my makeup and smile, rather than shy away from looking myself in the eye. Today I fit in my skin. I'm at peace with myself and the world around me. Thank you again so much for allowing me to share my experience, Strength and Hope.